This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to the other, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcohol, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Gloria will read the preamble.
Yeah, Gloria.
Hi, I'm Gloria and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholic Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, bring me the serenity to accept things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Aviva will read the steps.
Hi, my name is Aviva and I am an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Rob will read the traditions.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Rob. I am an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by an information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Alba.
Good evening. My name is Alba, and I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is January 19, 2007, and my sponsor is Katie C., and Atlantic Group is my home group. I say that because that's very important to me. And, sorry, I'm not that tall. I was thinking about sharing my experiences and what got me here January 19th, and I realized that it wasn't a bottom. You know, it wasn't that day that got me here. I started drinking very late, like, let's say 2021. But I had alcoholism in my family, unbeknownst to me. Last week was 20 years since my father passed away. And I had no idea, till I got sober, that my father was an alcoholic and that my childhood was broken because of his alcoholism. I wish I would have had a chance to know him. Because that's very important to me. Because alcoholism has destroyed a great part of my life. You know, I am 33 years old, and for 30 somewhat years I lived in insanity and pain, whether it was my own self-inflicted or whether it was done to me. So when I did pick up that drink, I didn't have it wasn't a revolution. You know, as growing up, I was always very driven and it was very positive. I wanted to be in the center of a leadership program and creating clubs, and it was a positive drive. And then when I picked up that alcohol, it became twisted. And that bottom, for me, lasted a good 10 years. I had so many bottoms in so many different places that at times it makes my stomach turn, and I'm like, how could somebody ever do that? You know, waking up in prisons with no shoes on, asking for money in different parts of the world, saying, how the hell did I get here? You know, it was that dramatic. That was my 10 years of a bottom. Every time I picked up, it wasn't a glass of wine. You know, I like to think the first real glass that when I started drinking was I went out to dinner. And I would always say, no, cranberry juice. No, just cranberry juice. And there was this bottle of wine, and it was a Corton Charlemagne, and that was poured, and I said, wow, it's white wine. It's not a big deal. It was a big deal because I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop with the glass. I had to have a bottle. And then wine wasn't good enough. And of course, I graduated to my vodka insanity. And when everybody went home, I wasn't going home. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, my party was starting. And then that day was over. It wasn't over for me. I just didn't sleep. You know, I look back at that, the mornings I've seen, the dawns I've seen, the life I missed out, you know, my relationships that I've missed out on. And the person that I could have been. Yes, I have those thoughts, you know. And it breaks my heart, you know. It really does, because I could have had those relationships that I blew away. And I guess I'm getting back to my father, because the one memory I have of him is when my mom came to pick me up. He was already getting sick. And I don't have a lot of good memories, unfortunately, but the memory is how he tried to reach me. I was going to the airport, and he ran, and he gave me these box of chocolates. It was like a red box of chocolates. And he said, here, I just wanted you to have this. And that's the one memory I have of my father. You know, alcoholism and alcohol robs beautiful things away. You know, and alcohol robbed me from a lot. But the only thing that saved me was in my last bottle on January 19, 2007, waking up in a mental institution. And, you know, it's not about me telling you these war stories, because trust me, I have the scars to prove them. It's really about, we all understand each other, whether you have one day or 20 years. And for me, it's about how I live today. Because when I woke up in that mental institution that I drove by to get here today, 2 years and a little over 2 months ago, I just had no idea what the hell hit me. And I remember really quietly, and I was sober at that point the next day, and I said, God, oh my God, I can't imagine anything being worse than taking away your freedom to walk out that door, to have a fresh, to breathe. And I said in my heart, it was quiet, it wasn't anything loud, because I was so used to bottoms at this point, and self-abuse and self-mutilation and self-degradation, and I could go on with the selves and selves and selves. It was nothing pretty. And I said, you know what, if I have a chance, I want a chance. Not because I just felt like I never lived. You know, I felt like, please give me a chance to live. And since that day, I did not pick up a drink. Because I know one thing very, very, I'm not confused here. This is not a game. I probably would not be here and be alive if I continued drinking. There's no doubt in my mind. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, I didn't know how to live with myself and with people and with my feelings. It's a manuscript for living. And you know, I understand that it could be confusing. And it was for me when I was here in 90 days, back on that seat, and I raised my hand and I said, I have 90 days, and I didn't even know why I was here, but I was here. The one thing that I have today in my life is that when things come up, I can understand why they come up. And I believe that I make the best choices. And it doesn't happen overnight. I had so much recovery to do that only recently that I really formed a relationship with God. My God. And because of that freedom is like, I don't carry those burdens. The burdens like, oh my God, I gotta be there, I gotta go there, I gotta do this. My relationship with my God is absolute trust. If I am here today, it's because I am here today. I wake up, I brush my teeth, I comb my hair, I call my sponsor, I call my mother. I live in my life, in reality, I pay my bills. You know, I don't lash out, I don't act like an animal towards other people who I have no right to judge. How dare you? You know, and it seems to be so, it's such a simple way, but for me, I just didn't know how. For those people in here today, especially those people that showed up like me new, it actually does work, and you actually have a way. What this has done for me is simply allowed me to live in my life. And the one thing I know for sure is my life is only going to get better. And all I have to do is trust the people in this room, your sponsors, trust people that have been there and done that. Really. Call your sponsor. The steps, it actually works. You know that? You know, and it's like, does this work? Yes, it works. Yes, you will be taken care of. Yes, you do not have to live in pain anymore. And I'm only talking not because I have a PhD on this thing, but I tell you, it's because of my own pain that I was gonna die. You know, it's dramatic to me because it was my life. So today I have a very good life and I'm very happy. Thank you. Thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Scott.
Hello, my name is Scott. I'm an alcoholic. Beautiful bunch. I'll start the same way as Albert did. Thank you very much. That was really great. And my sobriety date is November 3rd, 2007. My sponsor's name is Derek G. And my home group is the Atlantic Group. I got 10 minutes, so I'm not going to say too much about my story, because I drank for 20 years, and I wouldn't even scratch the surface. But I will tell you this, that my first drunk, I was in junior high school, and first I remember anyway, I blacked out. I went to a pre-prom party with a bunch of my friends whose sister, one of my friend's sister was going to the prom, so her parents bought like cases and cases of champagne. All I remember really is showing up, like chugging bottles of champagne, and then falling in a hot tub and waking up in a basement with a puddle of vomit next to me. That's all I remember of the whole night. I went back there a week later and went in the basement and the vomit was still on the carpet. And I literally could like peel it off in one piece and just hit it, you know. And that was what my drinking was like, you know, just like cover it up. No one's going to see what happened. It's all good. Nothing happened here, you know. And 20 years, you know. So let's fast forward now 20 years. I'm living with this woman who I believe to be like a gift from God that I finally found the one. And we're partying like rock stars, right? So like, all I know is I woke up in the hallway with my bags packed and I had no idea how I got there. Blacked out again. And apparently I went off on her verbally and I said, well, how did my bags get packed? She's like, you packed them. You're out of here. And I had no idea. You know, so she was done with me and it was over. I was just like so depressed, so sad. How did my life get to this? And I'm skipping a lot. Trust me. 20 years worth of stuff. two DUIs, 7 days in jail, you know, I mean, I could spend hours, but I won't. So that night, it was over. You know, I lost the love of my life. What do? I go to work, miserable. As soon as I get out of work, I go to the bar, I get wasted, I go home, I pass out. I think I urinated on myself, like I got woken up, but I actually had spilt the Jim Beam that was in my hand because I had passed out, and I was just so broken at that point. I called up my cousin, and I said, and I had tried AA once before, it didn't work, and I'll tell you real quickly, it was because I had partied too hard. My sister wanted to take my other sister, who was sick, to the doctor. She was very sick, and I couldn't do it because I was too sick from partying to take my sister to the doctor. So I'd given up then, and I'll tell you, that didn't even work. I kept on partying. So that morning I was done. I called my cousin, can you drive me to my girlfriend's house to get my stuff? He's like, if you don't get to an AA meeting, I'm going to come there and drag you to one. So I went. And from that moment on, I went. I went every day. I went. I did 90 and 90. And it sucked at first. I'm not going to lie. But I'm going to tell you, like, there's three stages of God that I've come to realize that helped me find my God as I understand him now. And first, it was the gift of desperation, G-O-D, gift of desperation. Second, it was being in a room, a group of drunks, going to AA meetings and identifying with that group of drunks. Third was good orderly direction, okay, taking direction from my sponsor, from people in the rooms who have experience. So those G-O-D acronyms helped me find the power greater than myself that I understand today. And I'll tell you what, I was never a God guy. Like, I was brought up in a household like, God's going to punish you if you don't do this, that, and the other thing. And I was like, who needs him then, you know? But I tell you now, like, I'm going to tell you, God gets me through every single day now. Like, there's no, I mean, when all else fails, I've got that relationship. And it's just an incredible thing. And it took a lot of work to get there. You know, I've worked the steps. My sponsor's amazing. I call him every single day. And, you know, when it comes to faith, you know, I was listening to Joe and Charlie, and, they have a great analogy. They talk about Christopher Columbus and the formula for change. And it comes down to four things, okay? First, you gotta be willing. And they talk about Columbus. Second, you gotta believe. Third, you gotta make a decision. And fourth, you gotta take action. Right? So Christopher Columbus. He decides he's going to find a better trade route to the East Indies or the West Indies. And he's, you know, he's willing to take this on. It's a lot. And then, you know, but secondly, he's got to believe that the earth is round. Because if it's flat, he's going right off of it, right? Thirdly, he makes a decision that, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get the money. I'm going to build the boats. I'm going to get the provisions. I'm going to hire the personnel. We're going to do this thing. But even with that decision, he's still standing on the shore. He hasn't done, you know, he hasn't gone anywhere yet. He has to take action, get on the boat and start sailing, right? That's how things happen. And, they say on the first trip, he had some guy standing up on a post with a lantern just in case the earth was flat. You know, they can turn back around, you know, in time. So they didn't quite have the faith yet, right? But through the actions, they got there, they found land, yes, you know, it's here, we were right, boom, boom, boom. They were supposed to get all these jewels and stuff, they never got, they came back, the queen's like, where's my stuff? He's like, I tell you what, if you pay for me, I'll go back. So she does, he goes back, but this time, no guy with a lantern, because they had that faith. They knew that they weren't going to go off the edge. I know I'm going to be taken care of. Because I have found that faith through taking the actions of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's an amazing thing. So if you're here and you're a little overwhelmed by this huge group of people, I'm going to tell you, man, there is so much love in this room. It's unbelievable. And if you start coming and just people start seeing your face, start reaching out hands, maybe get a service commitment, just talk to people, get phone numbers. It'll get smaller and smaller. You'll start recognizing people. People will start recognizing you. You'll see the smiles. You'll start smiling. You know, there'll be things to do, places to go, you know, and you'll start feeling pretty good about yourself. You're like, wow, I don't need to drink and be miserable all the time. I can hang out with these happy people, you know? But you gotta do work. Every single day, you've gotta do work. And you start feeling peace, right? Now what is peace? You know, I have this sticker, it's a magnet on my refrigerator that says peace is not just like sitting up on a mountaintop all by yourself with no noise, no sounds, no people. Cause I'll tell you what, I've been on a lot of mountaintops, but guess who's on that mountaintop? This guy right here. And Grand Central Station is going on inside the head. So like, peace is being able to find that serenity among the chaos. And again, how do you achieve that? The work. You gotta get to the bottom of things. That's through the 12 steps. I was talking with Scott, this other Scott that, we were at the Big Book meeting. Yeah, I was talking to myself. I do that a lot. But no, really, there is another Scott, and we were talking at the Big Book meeting not too long ago, and we were talking about how fear, everything comes from fear, right? And in the beginning, like fear, when I was a kid, it was like, fear is like a little snowflake. It's this pure, genuine thing, no big deal, just a little bit of fear, it's healthy, right? But what does that do? I mean, it's steamrolled. It starts like trickling down the mountain, and it starts building momentum, and now it's this huge snowball, and it's out of control, you can't stop it, people are jumping out of the way, and it becomes this avalanche, and it just like takes out everything in its path, it destroys everything, and boom, now you're stuck underneath this huge, huge avalanche of snow, and you've got this pocket of air, and it's like your second chance, and all you gotta do is just start digging, 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 and you got all of us on the top of that snowbank, digging, 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 and reaching their hand out, and all you gotta do is do your part, and we'll pull you out, but you just gotta do your part. So if you're new, come, get a sponsor, get phone numbers, put out your hand, and just get to know people. Make the effort. It's really, really worth it. My life is amazing today. Amazing. I've met so many cool people. I do so many cool things. And it's just a matter of doing the work on a daily basis. Thank you very much.
Our main speaker tonight is Snow.
My name is Snow, and I am an alcoholic. Yeah, I don't want that to be in my nose. I want to say welcome to all the newcomers. Welcome home. Welcome home. How do you stop dancing with a 1,000-pound gorilla? You get something bigger than the gorilla. You just found something bigger than the gorilla. And I, in my experience, it works. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most phenomenal place on earth. What makes me an alcoholic? I have an allergy to alcohol. When I drink, I can't stop. And I was the last one to find out. And my sobriety date is March 7, 1975. Now, I'm allergic to clams too, but I haven't had to go to meetings for 34 years for my clam problem. This is a disease that centers in the mind. And that's where I have to keep the mental housekeeping. I have to keep coming back here to keep the house clean, to fill it up with the God part, to get the solution. The inside of me was one big God-shaped hole that I tried to fill with alcohol, cigarettes, bad boys, and all kinds of things. And there was nothing I could ever do to make that shape go away until I came here. And the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous loved me sober every minute. And you can get loved sober too if you just keep coming back here. The trick is just don't pick up one drink and you can't get drunk. Amazing, astounding information that I heard when I came here. I had a perfectly normal life up until the age of 6 months old. At that point, my parents went off the deep end, my siblings went into an orphanage, and a kindly neighbor brought me to a relative who worked in Cotman's Bakery in the East Bronx. And I began my journey with some loving, wonderful people who were kind and generous, who never adopted me. And that feeling of not belonging any place was with me my whole life until I crawled in here. I had lots of drinks when I was young. My social drinking was 7 to 9 years old. I got busted shoplifting dolls' clothes at 9 years old. I was smoking at 11 and falling down drunk on my face at 14 years old. I remember having a hot toddy when I had a sore throat, which was whiskey and honey and all kinds of goodies in there. And it was Christmas time. And I tell you, that Santa Claus was winking at me. This tinsel on the tree was dancing. And I belonged with this family. They had a son and a daughter, 10 and 15 years older than me. And it was like Ozzie and Harriet, you know. And I was the weird Puerto Rican kid in this Italian family. And but I belonged when I had that hot toddy. And so I used to get sick a lot. And one day I lit the thermometer, and I don't know, everything's digital now, but when you take a match to a thermometer with mercury in it, it flies all over the place. And that's when I started lying about, you know, what I was up to. But the alcohol made me feel better. It just made me feel good inside, and that's why I drank. It changed the way I felt, changed the way I saw the whole world. It changed the way that I thought people saw me. It made me everything I wasn't. I forgot my story, Peg. I remember at 14 years old, I just wanted that oblivion. I used to go to visit, they'd take me to see my siblings in the orphanage, and I had this like little white dress on. You know, it was only a $2 dress from Alexander's, but I always felt like I was the survivor. I had that survivor's guilt. And I would scream and cry, and then I was afraid they were going to leave me. I had all this fear and guilt and shame, and then I went to Catholic school. And you know, that just compounded the whole thing. I got a nice little magazine in seventh grade once, and I wanted to get this really cool hairdo, and I copied it, and I was sitting in the front of the church, and Sister Georgiana came and dragged me out of the church, calling, screaming at me, a beatnik, that I was a beatnik. And, you know, and I was sitting there praying for that miracle. I'd watch that 10-inch TV in the tenement on the fourth floor, sit there, that little black and white TV, and I watched the movie with the little children of Fatima, and I'd pray for the miracle that they had. I wanted a miracle. Please give me a miracle. And then I'd watch Myrna Loy, the thin man, and I wanted those martinis that they had, and the tuxedos. The guys were always dressed, and women were in silk dresses, and, you know, a topper, and everything was so elegant. I wanted my life to be elegant. And in 1956, they broadcast the Olympics for the first time, and I sat there watching the ice skater. And I said, how do you get there from here? There was nobody to ask. I felt like other people got the map, and I never got the map. You know, my parents who raised me never got out of sixth grade. They were kind people, very kind people, but I couldn't ask them anything. There were no directions. I tried to get them to adopt me legally. They never could. They didn't want to upset my real parents, and they said, you know, I finally got a lawyer in when I was 16, and he said, well, she's going to be married soon anyway, so haha, what did I do? I was dating a guy in high school who I was supposed to marry. He got drafted to Nam, and I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to have a nice station wagon, white picket fence, everything's going to be fine, and I'll wait for him to come home, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited. Two whole months must have gone by, and he wasn't back from the war. And that's when the tortured poet on the motorcycle came by. And I jumped on the back of that baby, and we ran away to Greenwich Village, and that was the Magical Mystery Tour, my friends. That was the whole psychedelic 60s, and it was just absolute insanity, absolute insanity. I got to the point where we moved up to Mamaroneck, and we're living in an attic apartment. And, you know, I took LSD to find God, but I couldn't even find the kitchen. And that's mainly because we didn't have a kitchen. But, you know, we didn't need things like that. I got to the point where I couldn't really speak anymore. I was a vegetable. People would ask me, how are you? And I didn't know what the right answer was. My husband would dress me and put me in a corner, and then I'd have a suicide attempt. And then he'd say to me, well, you know, the life of a worm is better than no life at all. And that's the self-esteem I had. That kept me alive. Thinking that over and over and over in my head kept me alive for another week. And that's how I lived, just trying to find one bit of hope after another. But my old friend came and saved me. I got my hands on a bottle of Wild Turkey. 101 proof, yes! I knew what the answer was to how are you. I'm fine. And the Wild Turkey worked for me, and I decided I had to get away from all these crazy people. So I moved to California. And the 60s in California was very interesting. Also, Red Mountain wine was $1.49 a gallon, and I lived with a lot of students who had people who actually sent them to school. You know, I didn't know how you did that. How do you go to school? How do you go to college? How do you do these things? So I just watched them. And I would say about once a month, my life was in danger. And it was just the way that I lived. A friend of mine, one of my roommates, we got in the car and we were going to see Jimi Hendrix in Monterey. We ran out of gas and a madman with a gun picked us up. And you know, this was just what happened. We drove up to the, he had us in the car in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and he stopped at a stop sign. Now, he doesn't mind, you know, raping and killing us, but he doesn't want to break the traffic laws. So I jumped out of the car, and he looked at me, and he said, if you don't get back in the car, I'm going to blow her brains out. And I'm there, and I'm like this tough New York girl. I've got my bomber jacket on and my sunglasses. And she's about 5 foot nothing, tiny little blonde curls. And I look at her, and I get back in the car. And, you know, I have had angels watching out for me my whole life. And when he let us out of the car with the gun pointed at my back, I just kept falling down. I've had so much fear in my life, just falling down, falling down. I finally found a house in the dark that let us in. And, you know, and then this little five-year-old boy comes and he wants to play ball with me. And the extremes of my life have always been, the only way I could deal with them was with alcohol. I stayed in bed for 3 weeks. All my friends just kept bringing me bottles of wine. That's how, if I wasn't drinking, I was on my way to a drink or in the middle of a drink. And I didn't know how much my life revolved around alcohol until I stopped. About a month later, when I finally did get out of bed, I went hiking in Big Sur, jumped off a cliff and broke my back, and was in the hospital, and I was detoxing, which I didn't know that's what was happening to me. And it took me about 3 days until I heard about a girl down the street, down the ward, who could get me some wine. And then, so the party began. What happened after that? I moved up to Eureka, where the students went, because they migrated up there for the summer. And I was down to my last bottle of wine, walking down the road, didn't know what I was going to do. And this gentleman said to me, well, would you like to move in with me, Snow? I said, sure, great idea. And about a week later, he asked me to water his garden with him. Well, we went to water his garden, and it was quite an illegal garden. And three policemen jumped out of the bushes, and we had us on the road, and he said, Snow, how'd you like to go back to New York? He whispers in my ear. I said, I'd love to. He said, start running. So I'm here to tell you, I've never been to a detox, a treatment center, a jail, or a psychiatric ward yet. And mostly because I ran fast. Nobody ever took me. And I didn't get caught, and I'm really grateful for that, because I think that they would have locked me up and thrown the key away. I came back, and I always thought that things outside of me were going to make me better. First of all, I thought that when trouble happened, it was the kind of drink. that I needed to change. When I had concentrated orange juice and gin at the drive-in theater at 14 with my friend Eric, I thought it was the gin, so I never drank gin again. When I had a Manhattan and I barfed all over the bride, I knew it was the Manhattans. You know, I didn't drink Manhattans again. I always thought it was the kind of alcohol, not the alcohol itself that was damaging my life. And then I thought the outside things are going to do it for me. I got a job and became a director of promotion of an ad agency in about a year and a half after I started as a receptionist. And I got the outside thing going on. It was always a different outfit, different kind of people, different music. I moved in with a girlfriend from high school, threw the Bob Dylan records away, got the Paul Anka records out, started dating the married men like her. You know, the outside stuff. And then after that, I took out a bank loan and bought furniture. Well, the furniture is going to straighten me out. It was always going to be something outside of me that would do it. It was going to be money. It was going to be an education. I went to school for 3 weeks. I had hepatitis. I couldn't go anymore. And the night of my last drunk wasn't, there were no blue lights. There was no big traumatic thing. There was only my ex-husband and my bookkeeper in my apartment bouncing off the walls. And I had said maybe 20 times that night, I don't want to drink tonight. I don't want to drink tonight. And I couldn't not drink. And that was my last drunk. And I thought up until that very last night, I could stop anytime I wanted to. I got that blessed moment of clarity where I knew it had me. I didn't have it. And if you're here tonight, you've had that moment. Hold on to it with all your might because it is the beginning of a brand new life. When I was 19, my doctor told me I needed to go to AA. So I had heard that information previously. And I came to AA, and getting sober was the hardest thing I ever had to do in my life. I don't want to ever do it again. I don't have whatever it takes to do it again. I was told you only have to do it once. And one of the people who loved me and held me and invested time and energy in me is sitting here someplace tonight. Where are you, John? I love you. I haven't seen John in almost 30 years, and he came tonight. Your love was not in vain, my friend. I detoxed sitting at the tables. I shook. I tore up the coffee mugs. I tore up the styrofoam cups. I had piles sitting there. I had uncontrollable spasms of my arms and my legs. I detoxed right there. The old men with no teeth who drank Sterno told me, you only got to do this once, kid. Just don't drink for tonight. Just don't drink for the next half hour. You only have to do it once. And I believed them. And I have believed people in this program ever since. And nobody steered me wrong yet. About 2 weeks passed, and the guy came in, and he was shaking as much as I was, and he'd sat next to me. He was sitting outside, and my sponsor said to me, go over and say hello to him. I said, what am I supposed to say? I don't even know where I am yet. She said, well, you didn't have a drink for 2 weeks. It's 2 weeks longer than him. Go shake his hand. So I went over to him, and I said, hi. He said, can I kiss you? Now, I don't know if I want this AA thing, but I don't want to blow it, if this is what you're supposed to do. Meantime, it's 1975. I've got platform shoes. I got hot pants on. I've got a gauze shirt. And, I said to my sponsor, what should I do, Petra? She said, kiss him. I said, okay. I kissed him. So Lenny sat next to me every night. Every night. The table was levitating between the two of us, how much we were shaking. And about 3 weeks passed, and I came to that meeting that night, and Lenny wasn't there. And I said, what happened to Lenny? Where's Lenny? And they said, Lenny hung himself last night. And I stayed sober that night for me and for Lenny. And I understood how serious this disease is. You don't have to drink for it to kill you. It wants you bad. It wants me bad. It's out there in the parking lot doing push-ups, waiting for me. It's as strong as my sobriety. And I kept coming back, and then I said to John, you know, all these guys are following me all around. I was in my 20s. You know, what am I going to do? They're just driving me nuts. He said, buy a bra. I did. You know, my life was always in my head, my fantasy world. I'd go to bed with James Bond and wake up with Daffy Duck. You know? It was always a different thing going on here. I wanted this magical man to come into a bar and find me and discover me and tell me who I was and how wonderful I was and have a family. And I only drank in gay bars. Getting into reality was tough. It was really tough. But I had fantastic sponsors, and I still have fantastic sponsors. I've been able to do all the things little girls dream of doing. I have been able to. And we don't promise you here that you'll do anything, but if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. But I have been able to go to college. I went to a doctor after about a year to try to get some funding for school. And he said, man, you got a borderline personality disorder. You got your bipolar and something else I don't remember. And my sponsor had told me, stay away from anybody who makes you feel like drinking. And when I came out of that guy's office, I wanted to get stewed to the Mickey. So I didn't go back. And I wasn't required to go back for another year. And I went back a year later and he said to me, you're a different person. What'd you do? I said, I didn't drink and I went to meetings. Even those with grave emotional problems can recover if they have the capacity to be honest. The 12 steps are the exit from total insanity. I remember going to meetings thinking that I'm too crazy for this thing. It's never going to work. I was standing out in the lobby at 7 months sober at the Mamaroneck meeting thinking I am totally insane. It'll never work for me. I'll just go for another 10 minutes. And I went to the meeting for another 10 minutes. I was okay when I came out. You know, one more night in my pocket. I went on welfare so I could go to college. And I got hit by a car after the first year. Was incapacitated for about 14 months. And my sponsors taught me that I could still survive and I could do anything I needed to do. I did get back. I paid welfare back every dime, paid it forward. I got a scholarship too, and I went to Paris. I graduated from Parsons School of Design. I went to Parsons in Paris, and I could tell you that I don't think that anybody in welfare is going to Paris anymore, but they did pay my rent while I was there. I've had miracles happen in my life. I mean, I sat at meetings on the Seine and just pinched myself. How could this happen to me? I graduated. By my graduation day, I have a picture of my parents and myself standing there. I'm in my red cap and gown. I had gotten married. I had twins in my belly, and I'm standing there in a red cap and gown. And my parents, the look on their face is, how did she get here? How did she get here? They hadn't a clue. It's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. All because of it. I've been blessed. I'm married 27 years. Yes, you can stay married in sobriety to the same man. He is a social drinker. He calls Jack Daniel's sipping whiskey. Now, I can't pass an iced tea without draining the glass. What's up with sipping whiskey, you know? But God love him. I have raised a family. I have three beautiful children. Who are just incredible. My twins are 26. The baby's 23. She just graduated. They've all gone to college. She's going to law school. You know, I've had incredible things happen to me. But I've had horrible things happen to me, too. And I want to talk about one of the horrible things because these are crazy times. And at one point, I built a mansion, lived in a beautiful mansion in Florida. I still live in Florida. And we had our happily ever after going on there. And we decided to do a project with a next-door neighbor who lived in a $2.5 million house. And it was a restaurant project. We've had a couple of four-star restaurants. And This was, we had to get to the finish line. By the time we got to the finish line to open this place, we were broke. So we took in this partner and made it happen, and it was a phenomenal home run. Phenomenal home run. Right out of the box. And he decided he needed to have all the money. And it was a total, complete success and a total failure at the same time. Because what happened to us was we lost everything. We lost our home. I had a sponsee. Now, my children, I know how to be poor, but my children were raised in Boca Raton. They don't know how to be poor. They were little. They didn't know what was happening. One of my sponsees let me have a garage sale at her house, and they would sell their little toys, ripped my guts out. And we didn't even have enough money to move out of the house. I had to walk away from this incredible mansion that I had built. The devastation and the pain was unbelievable. The cars were taken away, and I had one car left, and I was commuting up to Palm Beach, running an art gallery up there. And about 11 o'clock at night, police stopped me, and the taillight was out on the car, and I didn't have any of the necessary papers. They towed the car away, and I just sat there and wept. I just sat there and wept. I couldn't believe something else was happening to me. And I got home, and I called the only person who was awake. We were in one tiny little apartment, the five of us, that we just were. I had a four-star restaurant, and I was feeding the kids hard-boiled eggs. And it was beyond comprehension to me. I had one friend awake in California, and I called her, and she said, "Change the channel. I'm sending you a plane ticket." So I ran away from home. 20-something years, sober friends, I ran away from home because I didn't want to drink. I wanted to die. I didn't know how to take care of my family. My husband was paralyzed. He couldn't believe that this had happened to us. And I get on the plane. I'm on the plane about a half an hour, and the plane starts going down. No warning. People start flying in the air. Coffee's flying all over the place. The guy next to me is barfing. People are saying goodbye to their kids. And I'm praying that, God, please don't let me die with this poison on my soul. Please help me to forgive this man who did this to my family before I die. Because I got a program. I got a program. And I know that my relationship with my higher powers, the only thing that's going to ever save me. I start saying the serenity prayer. I start saying the prayer from my childhood. Hail Mary, full of grace. Bless us now and at the hour of our death. Amen. I start saying the Our Father. I'm saying a sober rosary. I'm saying every prayer I know. They make an emergency landing, and my husband and my kids see me on TV. And I crawled to the phone, and I remembered something that a woman said at a meeting once. I think everything we hear at a meeting, we still have in there someplace. Her husband had died in a restaurant, and they asked her if she wanted whiskey, and she said, "No, thanks." And I thought to myself, this isn't that bad. I thought of that woman that day. When they asked me, they were giving out free booze to everybody. They asked me, "What do you want?" I said, "I'll have a hot tea, please." And I felt like that tiny bubble from the bottom of my soul started to rise, and I knew I could start my life over. I got this. When in any long-term relationship, there's not good days and bad days. There's good years and bad years. I finally got to a phone, and I said, "I can't. I just had this plane accident, and I'm stunned. I'm in shock." And he said, "Better you than me." This was not one of the good years. But I have been able to do everything that I have ever dreamed. Last year, I had an architectural company. I did huge carved ornamental ceilings. I worked for all kinds of wonderful people. I retired from that, and I travel a lot now. I have a tiny little travel agency. This drunken Puerto Rican from the Bronx actually got to see the Sistine Chapel last year. My mind is blown with how good it keeps getting. I stay in the middle of the pack. The 12 steps are really simple. The first four steps, you talk to yourself. The fifth step, you talk to one other human being. The seventh step, you talk to God, any God. The ninth step, you talk to all the people who you really, really hurt. By the 12th step, you're talking to God and all the other people on the planet. It's the end of isolation. It's the end of dancing alone with the devil. It's over. It's over. And we all have the map now. The 12 steps is the map. No matter what happens, I know I don't have to drink. No matter who lives or dies, I know I don't have to pick up a drink. Thank you so very much for listening.